Scottish church history, and we're beginning at 1690 in the Revolution Settlement, and we're going to get into the 1700s. Now that we've gotten to this point, things will start moving a lot faster. The Revolution Settlement of the Church of Scotland. The Estates of Scotland had told William of Orange, that it desired the establishment of prelacy because it, quote, hath been a great and insurmountable grievance and trouble to this nation. The Estates of Scotland had told William of Orange that it desired the abolishment of prelacy because it, quote, hath been a great and insurmountable grievance and trouble to this nation, and contrary to the inclinations and generality of the people ever since the Reformation, they have been reformed from popery by presbyteries, and therefore prelacy ought to be abolished. After William was established as king, the estates were converted into a parliament. Parliament has to deal with a mess left by 28 years of prelacy. The Scottish Parliament was divided into three factions. The first, known as the Jacobite Party, were supporters of James. They were composed of prelatists, papists, and supporters of absolute power in the crown. This party was actually quite strong, and most of its supporters came from the north. The second party was called the High Presbyterian Party, or the Club. The Club wanted to restore a pure presbytery, including the accomplishments of the Second Reformation. Most of the Club members, if not all, believed in the divine right of Presbyterian church government. The third party was the moderate Presbyterians. The moderate Presbyterians were content to have Presbyterian government set up by a parliament without any reference to divine right. The moderate party was willing to forego the attainments of the Second Reformation to reach a settlement. We could say they're the more pragmatic Presbyterians in the negative sense. The Jacobites were adept at pitting the moderate and high Presbyterians against each other. Meanwhile, King William, who actually preferred Presbyterian church government, believed that he must do nothing to upset the Episcopalian establishment. King William believed that Scripture did not prefer one form of government over another. What grew out of all this was a compromise settlement crafted so as not to offend King William and not to offend the English Episcopalians. So, prelacy was kept in England, and they have it to this day. They're ordaining sodomites and all sorts of perverted things. Presbyterianism in Scotland, and of course Scottish Presbyterian Church now, is totally apostate, and they ordain homosexuals as well. Let me just read about William of Orange by N.R. Needham. He says, William II and III, the second in Scotland and I think the third in the Netherlands, Prince of Orange, Stadtholder of the United Provinces of the Netherlands from 1672, and King of England, Ireland, and Scotland 1689 to 1702. After the flight of James VII, or the Second, in December 1688, Scottish representatives met William of Orange in London, where an agreement was made that he should administer Scotland's affairs until a national convention determined the future shape of its government. In March 1689, William summoned the Scottish estates, and the Williamites outnumbered the Jacobites. And on the withdrawal of the letter, the convention followed England's example. On the 11th of April, offered the Scottish crown to William and Mary, his wife, James VII's daughter. So old wicked James VII, who's a Romanist, had a Protestant daughter. In a document called the Claim of Right. In June, William recalled the convention as his first Scottish Parliament. Another was never elected during his reign. He simply kept the convention in being for nine successive sessions. The king was guided by William Carstairs in the ensuing religious legislation. Episcopacy was abolished, but Presbyterianism Presbyterianism was not established until Parliament's second session in 1690, by which time the unpopularity of the Episcopalian clergy and their Jacobite sympathies had overcome William's hesitations about Presbyterianism. Patronage was abolished, as was the Act of Supremacy, which comes from 1669, which had declared the monarch supreme in ecclesiastical affairs. William's Presbyterian settlement, however, was not based on the national covenant. So many Cameronians, or Covenanters, remained outside the restored Presbyterian Church of Scotland. Armed Jacobite resistance to William in 1689 was successful at Killiecrankie, Perthshire, the 27th of July. But they were defeated at Dunkeld, Perthshire, August the 21st. Jacobite sympathies among Highland clans simmered on, providing fuel for the risings of 1715 and 1745. William was more tolerant religion than the triumphant Presbyterians wished. He refused to interpret a clause in the Scottish coronation oath binding him to root out all heresies and enemies of the true worship of God, in a persecuting sense, and issued indulgences to 100 Episcopal clergy who acknowledged him as king. Only non-jurors were excluded. Despite certain autocratic tendencies in William's political conduct, his reestablishment of Protestantism in Presbyterian form at home, and relentless championship of its cause internationally against Louis XIV of France, guaranteed the loyalty of the majority of his Scottish subjects. He was a popular Protestant hero to the common people, although their sentimental enthusiasm was not shared by the ruling classes. So that's William of Orange. Presbyterian church government was secured, according to the Charter of Presbytery, 1592. The second Reformation period, 1638 to 1650, the most important and purest and best period of Presbyterian history, was completely ignored, except the Westminster Standards. Patronage was abolished, and the small number of ministers still alive who lost their churches in the 1660s had them restored. And out of, I don't know, 600 ministers, I think there were 40 left who were still alive. The act which asserted the king's power over all persons in all causes ecclesiastical was abrogated. An act ratified the Westminster Confession of Faith. An act stated that Presbyterianism is agreeable to the Word of God and most conducive to the advancement of true purity and godliness. Note, however, that it does not say that Presbytery is the only scriptural form of church government. The king wouldn't go along with that. Well, let's look at the defects of the settlement. Number one, the Westminster Confession was ratified, but the Acts of the General Assembly, in particular 1647, which stated that the church had the inherent right to call her own assemblies, was omitted. King William would claim the power of calling and dismissing assemblies. Not good. Number two, prelacy was abolished, but it was not said to be unbiblical. Number three, all the attainments of the Second Reformation except the confession were left buried in the Acts for Cicero, which was never overturned. Many other wicked acts were left in place. Number four, the covenants made with God in the Second Reformation were ignored as things men could forego. Okay, so solemn oaths or bonds with God could be rejected. Not good. Totally bad. Number five, at this time there were 900 parishes in Scotland, all of which had been occupied by men who had conformed to episcopacy. Large numbers who were left after the rabbling, and such were received in the Revolution Church. The rabbling is when the strict covenanters went around and they would get rid of the ministers. These would become the moderate Presbyterians, who over time would be largely responsible for nearly extinguishing evangelical religion and orthodoxy in the Church of Scotland in later years. Compromise, pragmatism, allowing declension, it's not a recipe for reformation. Of the roughly 400 ministers who were rejected by the drunken, corrupt Privy Council, only 60 were still living in 1690. So it's 60. And consequently, the Presbyterian Church was weak and in a poor spiritual state at the time of the Revolution settlement. It was unwilling to fight for the excellent biblical attainments of its spiritual forefathers. And Hewison notes the sad political and religious situation in 1690. Quote, the popish king was gone. The equally despised bishops were gone. And gone, too, was unanimity on the subject, civil or sacred. The seat of government was in a foreign land, for the Scots still reckon England to be more than over the borders. At home, contending parties dug pitfalls for one another. It looked as if there was not a statesman capable of laying the foundation of the Revolution settlement. Among the would-be leaders, indifferent, elastic, moderate, extreme as they variously were. The party shibboleths were prelacy, presbytery, covenants. The malcontents might have added place and power. The church now rent by schisms did not realize it in its inherent independent status and power, nor did it of itself rise into form and commanding station. A mere corpus vile, it waited to be galvanized into life by the touch of the civil ruler. Long a bureau of state, ordered to pray and preach as required, it had no voice. Its oracle was dumb. There was no Nehemiah on the walls, clarion sword at hand, no Knox disputed by the brethren to trumpet danger and defiance, no strong patriot to summon the folk mote and demand whether the people wished a pope, prelate, or presbyter to lead them to heaven. There was a wild maelstrom of conflicting opinions out of which the strongest, steadiest current ran into old Presbyterian channels. To return to the pre-Reformation allegory, the mariners, the country pastors, whichever way the wind blew, were content to remain in the ark, drifting as it were. They were concerned into settled waters. The persecutions, the compromises, the declension, the pragmatism had done extreme damage to the Presbyterian Church in Scotland. And the result was a very mediocre church. A church so corrupt, the Covenanters, rightly, in my view, remained separate. The adoption of the middle way, which fell short of what was clearly taught in the Bible, appeared to make sense in the short run when people were tired of strife and difficulties, but would come back to plague the church in the future. Short-term pragmatism makes for long-term disaster. And what's interesting is that even people who were not Covenanters recognized the wisdom and rightness of what the Covenanters did. Here's from John McClintock and James Strong. This is 1870s, I believe. Here's what they say. Covenanters, the name given primarily to that body of Presbyterians in Scotland who objected to the Revolution settlement in church and state, and desired to see in full force that kind of civil and ecclesiastical polity that prevailed in Scotland from 1638 to 1649. According to the Solemn League and Covenant ratified by the Parliaments of England and Scotland, and also by the Westminster Divines and at Westminster in 1643, Presbyterianism was to be maintained in the kingdoms of England, Scotland, and Ireland, and popery, prelacy, superstition, heresy, schism, etc., to be extirpated. The Covenanters in Scotland contended, as is well known, under much suffering for the species of Presbyterian supremacy throughout the reigns of Charles II and James VII, as a measure of pacification at the Revolution, Presbyterianism was established in Scotland by an Act of Parliament in 1690, but it was of a modified kind. Substantially, the church was rendered a creature of the state, more particularly as regards the calling of general assemblies. And prelacy was not only confirmed in England and Ireland, but there was a general toleration of heresy, that is, dissent. In sentiment, if not in form, therefore, this party repudiated the government of William III and his successors and still maintained the perpetually binding obligation of the covenants. The Covenanters acted under strong convictions and only desired to carry out to a legitimate issue principles which had always been found in the Presbyterian Church of Scotland, but which for prudential considerations had been long practically in abeyance. In short, it is the standards of the Covenanters that we have to look for a true embodiment of the tenets held by the great body of English and Scottish Presbyterians of 1643. And these men were not Covenanters, and they're admitting this. Others gave into the Revolution settlement, and afterwards found cause to secede. The Covenanters never gave in, and of course, never seceded. End of quote. It just gives you an idea how great they are in their obedience. In March 3rd, 1689, after the Revolution, the Covenanters solemnly renewed the covenants at Borland Hill. The service was attended by large numbers of people from the United Societies. The Covenanters had three ministers at this time: Alexander Shields, Reverend Lining, and Reverend Boyd. In 1690, Alexander Shields presented a petition to Parliament in the name of the persecuted people of the West and Southern Shires. The paper set forth the ideas, the requests of the Covenanters. The paper was rejected by a committee of Parliament and never reached the floor of Parliament. Let me just read you quickly about Alexander Shields. He lived 1660 to 1700. And this is from Sherman Isbell, an old buddy of mine. He's a retired minister now. Covenanter preacher and political theorist, born in the parish of Earlston, Berwickshire, the son of a tenant farmer. He graduated from Edinburgh University in 1675 and remained to read theology under Lawrence Chatteris. He early sided with the more radical Covenanters and enrolled as a theological student at Ulrecht in 1680. In London, he became annuminous to English Puritan John Owen and was licensed to preach by the Scottish Presbyterians of that city. He was arrested at a conventicle there in 1685 and returned to Scotland for imprisonment on Bass Rock off the East Lothian coast, but escaped the next year. He then sought out James Renwick, and as a close companion, aided Renwick in revising the Informatory Vindication. We mentioned that last week. In 1687, Shields took to Holland the manuscript for Renwick's book and also the manuscript for his own, A Hind Let Loose. Both were printed in Utrecht in 1687. Upon his return to Scotland, he preached to the field meetings of the Cameronians after the arrest of Renwick. And I've heard it's pronounced Rennick, so I've been pronouncing it wrong for 2 weeks. It's Rennick. Following the accession of William III, Shields concluded that continued separation from the Church of Scotland was inadmissible, and made his reconciliation to the church. He elected to leave the country as chaplain of the Cameronian regiment serving in Flanders in the war against France, and was ordained to this work by Edinburgh Presbytery in 1691. William III sought out the author when he visited the regiment. Shields was admitted to his only settled pastorate in 1697 as colleague to Thomas Forster in St. Andrews. In 1699, he was sent by the General Assembly as one of the Church of Scotland's first foreign missionary on the second expedition to establish a Scottish mercantile station at the Darien colony in Central America. Inability to converse with the Indians and the licentious living of the colonists frustrated the mission. Shields died of a fever at Port Royal, Jamaica. In A Hind Let Loose, Shields justified the Cameronian resistance to royal absolutism and the divine right of kings. He argued that government is divinely ordained, but people are entitled to bring a king to judgment for wrongdoing. Parliament is commissioned by the people to oversee the nation's affairs, but the compact between the people and their rulers does not entail a forfeiture of the people's power to depose tyrants and confer authority on someone else. Government is by consent and must justify itself to the consciences of the people. God has given men the right of self-defense, and this extends to a right not only passively to resist, but also to kill relentless persecutors. So that's Alexander Shields, and A Hind Let Loose is in print, or at least you can get it online. Scotland held its first General Assembly after the Revolution in October the 16th, 1690. King William wrote this assembly saying, quote, "Moderation is what religion enjoins. Neighboring churches expect from you, and we recommend to you." Okay, moderation. This assembly took basically the same course as the Parliament, which was to avoid offending the King and the Episcopal Church in England. The strict Covenanters settled delegation to this General Assembly to address their grievances with the settlement and so on. Patrick Walker, one of the Covenanters who attended the Assembly, wrote, quote, "We were long put off and with great difficulty got laid before them, many of them about the helm looking down on us with a frowny countenance. And when we saw many of our bitter-tongued persecutors sitting there as elders and had so little regard to our grievances and esteem of us, that they thought it not worth their while to give us any answer. These and other things made us come out with our hearts filled with sorrow." End of quote. The three Covenanter ministers, Shields, Lining, and Boyd, presented two papers to the Assembly, a long one and a short one. They wanted the Assembly to consider the Covenanter-held positions. A committee of the Assembly stated that the shorter paper could be read to the Assembly, but not the longer paper, because, quote, "though there be several good things in it, yet the same doth also contain several peremptory and gross mistakes, unseasonable and impracticable proposals, and uncharitable and injurious reflections, tending rather to kindle contentions than to compose divisions." Things haven't changed a bit, have they? The three ministers appeared before the Assembly and acknowledged the shorter paper. The Assembly adopted the report of the committee with one dissenting vote. Later in life, Alexander Shields stated that he regretted not taking a more bold attitude at this Assembly. The Free Church historian William Hetherington gives a sketch of the character of the body of ministers which met at this Assembly in 1690. Quote, "within the church there were three parties, the aged ministers who had been ejected at the commencement of the persecution in 1660, and having escaped its deadly perils were now the proper representatives of the Church of the Second Reformation, the ministers who had to a greater or lesser degree conformed to prelacy, accepted the indulgence, and became tainted somewhat with a tendency to laxity and indifference in doctrine, discipline, and government, and the unconquered Covenanters who had followed Cameron, Cargill, and Rennick, spurning every weak compliance, braving every danger, and sealing cheerfully their testimony in defense of Christ's crowned covenant with their blood. The ministers of the first party were not more than 60. Those of the last, only three, Shields, Lining, and Boyd. While those in the middle party accounted to more than double the number of both the others combined. It is perfectly manifest, therefore, that no measure which the more faithful and zealous party could propose could be carried, if the middle party should resolve to oppose it. And there was no reason to hope that men who had tamely submitted to the tyranny of Charles and James, and even bowed beneath the prelatical yoke, would readily assume an attitude of bold resistance to Erastian policy of William of Orange. Accordingly, from the very hour when it met, the Assembly was laid under the almost fatal necessity of entering into a compromise and keeping in comparative abeyance what its wisest and best members knew to be the great and essential principles of the true Presbyterian Church. Now, that's a Free Church guy saying this. You look back at history, who are the heroes? Who are the faithful ones? The Covenanters. The Covenanters. It's plain. The Covenanters. One reason, perhaps the main reason, Shields, Lining, and Boyd were subdued at this Assembly was the sad fact that at the same Assembly they applied for readmission into the Revolution Church. They promised the Assembly that they would be subject to the judicatories of the Church and to oppose schism and defection. Although Shields, Lining, and Boyd were treated rather harshly by this Assembly, all three joined the Revolution Church. Many years later, Shields told a friend that he let Lining and Boyd have too much influence on him. Quote, "they were in haste for Kirk's stipends and wives." End of quote. Shields defended his entering the Revolution Church to Patrick Walker by saying, "there are many good men in it." This, of course, was a total repudiation of the Covenanter principle that union or separation must be the basis of official legal and creedal, the official legal and creedal position of the Church, not just the character of its ministers. There are many fine ministers in the OPC. There are many fine ministers in the PCA. They're still corrupt, unfaithful denominations. When Shields, Lenning, and Boyd entered the Revolution Church, the Covenanters were left without an ordained minister. They would be without a minister for 16 years. Imagine that. No minister at all for 16 years. Even some of the society people, including the notable Patrick Walker, entered the Revolution Church. The Covenanters regarded the Revolution Church as a wicked, sinful compromise. In 1692, King William tried to force the General Assembly of Scotland to be one-half Presbyterian ministers and one-half Prelatists. The General Assembly refused and was dissolved by the King's representative. In 1693, the Parliament of Scotland passed an act which required all ministers of the Church of Scotland to subscribe to the Westminster Confession of Faith and to approve of Presbyterian church government. Not because it was the only scriptural method of church government, but as the only government of the Church of Scotland. This act was a move by Parliament to head off a confrontation between William and the General Assembly. Under this act, large numbers of former curates entered the Revolution Church. These men were unfaithful, lax, irreligious, and worldly-minded. These men became the allies of the lax moderate party in the church. This gave the moderate party the ascendancy, which led to the eventual destruction of orthodoxy within the church. Okay. Compromise, pragmatism, toleration leads to apostasy. It may take a long time, but it will happen. It will happen. You got to be tough. You got to be faithful. You got to be strict. You got to be confessional. After the defection of Shields, Boyd, and Lining to the Revolution Church in 1690, the Covenanters would be without a pastor until 1706. In 1706, the Reverend John Macmillan would become the pastor for the over 7,000 Covenanters in Scotland. That's a lot of people. That's about the size of the Covenanter Church in America today. At its peak, the Covenanter Church in America was about 12,500. Then they shrunk down to about 5,000, and they're up to about 7,000 now. Between 1690 and 1696, the Scottish Covenanters would occasionally make use of the services of the Reverend David Houston, a Covenanter minister from Ireland. When Houston died in 1696, England and Ireland, like Scotland, were left without a minister. The Covenanters were without the preaching of the word and the sacraments for many years because they absolutely refused to hear or receive sacraments from any of the Revolution settlement ministers. They believed they were covenant breakers. They believed it was wrong to countenance these covenant breakers. The Covenanters during this time faithfully met in their society meetings for worship, Bible study, and exhortation. The services were usually led by elders. Discipline, membership, fellowship, and such was continued in the society meetings. John Macmillan was born in 1669. His parents were members of a prelatical church. He graduated from the University of Edinburgh and then for a time was associated with the United Societies. Sometime before 1700, he left the Cameronians and received licensure in the Revolution Church in 1700. After being ordained, he ministered in the parish of Balmaghy. In 1702, events began that would convince Macmillan to go back into the Covenanter Communion. In 1702, Macmillan Synod instructed all ministers to teach a class explaining the National Covenant. Macmillan, in the session of his church, decided also to expound the Solemn League and Covenant. This was inconsistent with the spirit of the Revolution Settlement, which was to act as though the Solemn League and Covenant did not exist. The next step in Macmillan's journey back into the Covenanter fold occurred when his presbytery ruled that taking the oath of allegiance to Queen Anne should be left up to each individual to decide. They wouldn't condemn it. They wouldn't encourage it. This infuriated Macmillan, who filed a formal protest to the presbytery, complaining not just about their position on the oath, but also the whole Revolution settlement. The presbytery disregarded Macmillan's complaint, and then after a time, made a weak, half-hearted attempt to refute Macmillan's position. Macmillan became disgusted with the presbytery and stopped attending presbytery meetings. For a time, McMillan waffled back and forth on whether to obey Presbytery or to go his own way until finally he was deposed from the ministry. While McMillan continued to minister in his church, he was summoned to appear before the General Assembly. McMillan failed to appear. Then he finally met with a commission from the assembly where he signed a paper admitting he had committed great sins in ignoring the authority of Presbytery. McMillan then appealed to his presbytery to revoke his disposition from the ministry, whereupon his presbytery refused. McMillan then retracted all the promises he had made to the General Assembly to be obedient to ecclesiastical authority. McMillan continued his ministry, continued to live in the manse, and continued to receive his salary regardless of the General Assembly's actions. Throughout McMillan's ordeal, he had been making overtures to the strict covenanters who were strongly desired a pastor. Okay, we see that McMillan was by no means a perfect individual. But in the end, he did the right thing. McMillan, like anyone wished to leave the Revolution Settlement Church and join the Covenanters, was required to make a public confession of sin. In his case, for leaving the godly remnant and joining the Revolution Settlement Church. Okay, the RPCNA, when people leave the OPC and the PCA and join the RPCNA, they should make them confess that it was wrong to be part of a corrupt, covenant-breaking church. They don't do that because they are part of NAPARC. And of course, they celebrate Christmas, so they're covenant breakers too. But they should do that. McMillan repented and signed his confession on August the 14th, 1706. On August the 15th, he signed an additional paper stating his approval of the covenanter positions. The covenanters were now satisfied. They extended the call to McMillan, who accepted and became pastor at large to the 7,000 or so members of the 20 or more societies. While McMillan traveled about ministering to the Covenanters, he continued to preach at his church at Balgamie, went home, and he continued to live in the manse. Soon after, McMillan was received as pastor by the society people. A licentiate named John McNeil was received by them. McNeil, who was licensed in 1669, could not be considered by the United Societies because he did not have a presbytery. They did not have a presbytery. McNeil preached to the Covenanters faithfully until his death in 1732. When McNeil died, he was still not ordained. He had been a licentiate for 63 years because they didn't have a presbytery. And let me just say something about McMillan before we depart McMillan. This is from Gordon Ketty. He's an RPCNA guy, although he rejects covenanting openly. John McMillan, 1669 to 1753, first minister and principal founder of the RPC. Born in Barn Cowlaw near Newton Stewart, Galloway, his boyhood was spent under the shadows of persecution and the killing times. Although his family appears to have entered to the established church, from his youth, his sympathies were with the Covenanters. While a student at Edinburgh University, 1695 to 97, he associated with their societies, but on graduation, with an MA, 1697, returned to the Church of Scotland, took up theological studies, and was subsequently licensed to preach in 1700 by the Presbytery of Kirkcudbright. He served as a chaplain to the Lord of Broughton prior to ordination at Balmaghie, Kirkcudbrightshire, in 1701. The death of William III in 1702 reopened the question of spiritual independence of the church from the state. The Revolution Settlement had omitted any affirmation of the divine right of presbytery and the continued obligation of the covenants, National and Solemn League. McMillan and others petitioned presbytery with a list of grievances, calling for a return of these historic expressions of the church's spiritual independence. Presbytery was in sympathy with this basic perspective, but cautioned against precipitating action. This did not satisfy McMillan. Woodrow comments that the grievances were Whiggishly abundantly and suggests that McMillan could desire no more reason from the presbytery. The discussion thereafter moved from the agreed doctrine to disagreeable disputatiousness and issued an irregular and unjust deposing of McMillan on December the 30th, 1703. What's going on? He was disturbing the peace of the church by insisting on the covenants in orthodoxy. So what do? They defrocked him. Have things changed much? Not much. Now you just don't get a job. You won't get hired. You won't get approved by presbytery. Such was the devotion of his parishioners that he continued to preach unhindered in his church until 1715 and was to occupy the manse until 1727. Macmillan, meanwhile, renewed his association with the covenanting societies and on October the 9th, 1706, accepted a call to be their minister, their first since the martyrdom of James Renwick, 1688, and the defection of William Boyd, Thomas Lining, and Alexander Shields, 1689. The 1707 Union and the 1711 restoration of patronage in the Church of Scotland confirmed him in his covenanting principles. They were, quote, fresh instances of the apostasy of the nation, RP testimony. Historical part, page 201. The covenants were renewed at Arkansas in 1712. Macmillan ministered tirelessly and with evident effectiveness to a scattered community of some 10,000 people. Okay, some say 7,000, some say 10,000. Worship was conducted in homes, barns, and in the open air. There were no church buildings until well after this time. For 37 years, he was the only minister. But with the accession of Thomas Narn, 1743, the Reformed Presbytery was formed, and an organized church took shape. He died at Broomhill, Lanarkshire. More than any other single individual, Macmillan gave form and direction to the RP movement, including a Presbyterian structure and missionary plan, which would in the course of time plant sister churches in Ireland, the USA, Canada, Australia, and Japan. His son by his third wife, Grace Russell, his earlier wife bore no children. John Macmillan II, 1729 to 1808, succeeded him in the RPC ministry. And his daughter, Grizel, married John Thorburn, RPC minister of Lonehead. His published works are few. The true narrative of the case of the presbytery, 1704, is anonymous, but certainly is almost certainly his. Other pieces include Protestation, Declinature and Appeal, 1708, and a poem, An Elegy Upon Mrs. Mary Gordon, 1723. In 1707, a treaty of union was achieved between England and Scotland. The seat of Scotland civil government was transferred to England, placing Presbyterianism in Scotland in a precarious position. Hetherington says that, quote, that from this time onward, the Church of Scotland presents the melancholy aspect of a declining and unfaithful church. Assailed by enemies without and corrupted and betrayed by worse and more deadly foes within her own communion. The union was bad because the British legislature had every intention of reducing the Scottish church to a servant of the English political will. In January 1712, a bill was passed by the British Parliament called the Act of Toleration. This bill gave legal toleration to the English dissenters in Scotland who desired to use the Episcopal liturgy, sacred calendar, holy days, and so on. It also forbid the civil authorities to add civil sanctions to ecclesiastical sanctions. For example, in a truly Christian country, an excommunication for adultery could then be tried and executed. This is how it works. Somebody brings a complaint. The church convicts them of adultery. The church then turns them over to the state for prosecution with the same witnesses. Then he could be prosecuted and put to death. That ended. In 1697, 21-year-old Thomas Aikenhead was executed for committing blasphemy against God and the persons of the Holy Trinity. The Act of Toleration was hated by the Scottish people, yet the Revolution Church did nothing. Now, Presbyterians today, they embrace holy days and corruptions willingly, with no pressure from the state. So we see that the church today is worse. Most churches today that say they're Presbyterian are worse than the Revolution Settlement Church, which was terrible. The Revolution Church remained silent. The Covenanters did not remain silent. They took the opportunity in 1712 to renew the covenant, the National Covenant, and the Solemn League and Covenant at Alcansas. This is known as the Alcansas Renovation. The society people, with uplifted hands, swore to the Solemn League and Covenant, article by article. Several days of prayer, fasting, and exhortation were spent at Alcansas as the Covenanters renewed the covenants. In 1733, a split occurred within the established Church of Scotland, known as the Secession. One of the main events which led to the Secession occurred at the General Assembly of 1731. The Assembly, dealing with the planting of vacant churches, ruled that, quote, that the minister should be chosen by the majority of the elders and of the inheritors, if Protestants. Because the call of the Christian people was totally ignored, many in the church were dissatisfied with the Assembly's decision. The Assembly dealt harshly and arrogantly with those ministers who disagreed with their enactment. And that enactment is totally unbiblical. The people have a right to call their own pastor. Now, it can be vetoed by a session, but the people have that right, and they take part in a vote. The more immediate cause of the secession was a sermon delivered to Synod by the moderator, Ebenezer Erskine. Reverend Erskine was fed up with the decline and corruptions in the church and boldly rebuked the church leaders in his sermon on Psalm 68:22. I'd love to get a hold of this sermon. I want to see this sermon. The Synod was greatly offended by Erskine's sermon and therefore voted that Erskine be rebuked. Erskine appealed his sentence to the next assembly. In May 1733, Erskine was rebuked and admonished before the assembly. Ebenezer Erskine, Alexander Moncrief, William Wilson, and James Fisher, you've heard of Fisher's Catechism? It's James Fisher. If you don't have it, get it. It's fantastic. James Fisher protested against the assembly's rebuke. The matter would have probably ended there, except that a page of the protest fell on the floor and was picked up by a member of the assembly. The member read the page and was so outraged at what it said. He then rose and told the assembly that these men were guilty of a treasonous insult against the assembly. The men were ordered to retract their protest, which they refused. In November, the assembly voted and cast these men out of the ministry of the established church. Yeah, the assembly did them a big favor. At this time, the assembly was evenly divided between those who were evangelical and those who were drifting from orthodoxy. The evangelical party wanted to keep these men in the established church. The assembly of August 1733 even released the four ministers from their sentence. The seceders were glad to be out of the established church and said they would only return if the current form of patronage was abolished, which was out of the question. The seceders were joined by four more ministers in 1737. The seceders were evangelical and orthodox in doctrine and strict on discipline. Like the Covenanters, the Secession Church believed in the perpetual obligation of the Scottish covenants in Scotland and the sole headship of Christ over the church. What clearly sets the Covenanters apart from the Secession Church was the Covenanter doctrine of Christian civil government. The Covenanters held that a nation must recognize the mediatorial kingship of Christ and therefore enter into covenant with the Son. Isn't that taught in the Psalms? Kiss the Son, kings of the earth, lest you perish in the way, kiss the Son. They also held that anyone holding a civil office must meet scriptural requirements. The seceders, who came to be called the Associate Presbytery of Scotland, rejected the Covenanter view of civil government. The Associate Presbytery excommunicated the Reverend Thomas Narn for his political views when he left them to join the Covenanters. When Thomas Narn joined the United Societies in 1743, the Covenanters were able to form a presbytery. Macmillan, Narn, and the ruling elders formed the Reformed Presbytery on August 1st, 1743. While the United Societies continued to meet for several years, now all ecclesiastical functions were handled by the presbytery. So that's a long, long period. That's 53 years. 54 if you go from 1689, before they have a presbytery. That's a long time. In 1745, the covenants were renewed again at Arkansas. The Lord's Supper was also celebrated. From 1744 to 1751, five young men were licensed to preach and then ordained by the Reformed Presbytery. One of these men was John Cuthertson, who would go and minister to Covenanters in America. In 1774, Cuthbertson would play a crucial role in forming the first American Reformed Presbytery. In 1753, the Reformed Presbytery split over the issue of the extent of the atonement. A book written in 1698 by the Reverend James Frazier, a minister of the Revolution Church, was published in 1749 by a Seceder minister. The book, A Treatise on Justifying Faith, basically teaches the doctrine of universal atonement. That Jesus Christ died both for the elect and the reprobate. Reprobate humanity. Christ died for the elect to bless them. And the reprobate so they could come under a more severe judgment. Christ, in the general sense, satisfied the sins of all mankind. In 1749, the Reformed Presbytery rejected Frazier's doctrine. The Reformed Presbytery denied the twofold significance of the atonement. And the Reformed Presbytery rejected the idea that Christ, by his death, purchased direct benefits for the reprobate. The reprobate do receive indirect benefits only as a consequence of God's blessings to the elect. The Reformed Presbytery stated also, quote, that the Lord Jesus Christ represented and died upon the cross only in the room instead of a select number of mankind, end of quote. The matter was formally considered by Presbytery in 1753 because some covenanter ministers still held to Frazier's view. The Presbytery meeting consisted of four ministers and five elders. Cuthbertson was in America, and Narn was under censure for immorality. Frazier's doctrine of the atonement was voted upon and rejected as dangerous by a vote of 5-3. Macmillan, his son, and three elders voted against Frazier's view. Reverend Hall and two elders voted in favor of Frazier's view. The moderator, who didn't vote, agreed with the minority. Okay, so did the Covenanter Church have problems?
Yes.
Serious problems, because the church is made up of sinners. Did they deal with the problems biblically?
Yes, they did.
The minority rejected the majority vote, and the following day asked the Presbytery to suspend the majority from the ministry. While the majority were taking a break, the minority abjured Presbytery and slipped away. And all the minutes of Presbytery, prior to this have never been recovered. They were lost. The minority group, who held to a heretical view of the atonement, formed the Reformed Presbytery of Edinburgh. This group died out around 1817. The minority group suffered splits of its own and even rejected parts of the Westminster Confession of Faith. Some of the original founders of the Reformed Presbytery of Edinburgh became members of the First Unitarian Church in Edinburgh. So it tells you what happened. Okay, we're going to stop there. We'll stop there, but it gives you an idea. The Covenanters are the most faithful expression of Presbyterianism in the world. But don't think they were perfect, and don't think they didn't have their problems, and don't think there wasn't immorality and schisms and all kinds of things going on. But the question is, are they going to remain faithful? Now, when we get to the 1800s, we'll note that they adopted all kinds of things that are terrible. You couldn't be a member unless you took a vow not to drink alcoholic beverages. That's Phariseeism. That's legalism. That's totally unlawful. And then they took part in societies to liberate the slaves, and these societies were run by a bunch of Unitarians. They did a number of things that were unbiblical, and then there'll be the split with David Steele, which eventually will become the Steelites, although David Steele and his followers were much better than modern Steelites. But we'll look at this next time. Let us pray. Father, we thank you so much for your word, and we thank you for your history. We ask, Lord, that we could be faithful to the covenants, that we could be faithful to biblical theology. We could be faithful to the attainments of the Reformation. And that the temptation to be pluralistic, the temptation to be pragmatic, the temptation to go along to get along so everybody will think we're loving and nice, that we avoid all that and remain hard-nosed in our orthodoxy and dogmatism, that we don't move one iota from the biblical position. Help us, Lord, to be faithful. In Jesus' name, amen.